Welcome to Skills for Crisis, a podcast for those who don't think it will get better, but keep trying. A podcast about discussing the tools, practices, and solidarities we might need to face crisis together. The podcast is part of the project Skills for Crisis, nurturing communities beyond tipping points. We went on a journey through topics around recentering mental health, solidarity in times of climate disasters, civil society work and mutual aid, and understanding the path of people on the move. The project is inspired by many activist groups, individual work, generations of thoughts and events. The main partners to organize this series of workshops, lectures and media outputs are three collectives, which are HOMOS, Educut Collective and Jazz Kulturi. We are educators, publicists and activists from Germany, Austria, Poland and Belarus. We want to thank, appreciate and honor generations of Black, Indigenous and people of color activists that have inspired us and many of the concepts and resources, like those contributing to the book Hospicing Modernity by Vanessa Machado de Oliveira, Adrienne Marie Brown and many others. My name is Fina, I am your host for today, and I'm part of Educut, a collective that does political education in Germany. Today, we're talking about strengthening civil society through mutual aid. As ecological breakdowns, authoritarianism, and war deepens, communities no longer can and want to wait for governments or NGOs to meet their survival needs. Mutual aid, our ability to take care of each other, was, is, and will be the number one survival response strategy and a way to build resilient, self-organized movements. Crisis is no longer a faraway future. It's here. Wildfires, floods, war, fascism, our systems are cracking. And for many people, they've always been broken. The question is, how do we survive and resist together when the very institutions that claim to protect us are failing and communities are busy fighting? The answer starts here, mutual aid. Not charity, not service provision, but communities building parallel structures of care, survival, and solidarity.
Thanks for coming to the podcast today with us. Mm-hmm. I'm Fina from Educut Collective. We know each other from a project we've been working on, Skills for Crisis. And you have been doing a workshop with us, two workshops actually, one offline and one online on mutual aid. Thank you so much for that. It was very interesting.
Yeah, I loved doing that and getting to meet people in this different context, talking about these ideas.
Yeah. So I'm joined by you. I'm just going to shortly introduce you. Dean Spade is an organizer, writer and teacher. Dean Spade has been working to build queer and trans liberation based in racial and economic justice for the past two decades. He is a professor at the Seattle University School of Law in the US, and currently we have the joy to have you with us in Berlin. Thank you so much for being here and for hosting the workshops Strengthening Civil Society Work and 101 Mutual Aid throughout our project. Thank you so much. Before we dive in deeper in the topic, could you guide us through a short practice, maybe, to help us arrive here, come to the space, and settle in the conversation?
Yeah, totally. I love this question, and when I was thinking about us meeting, and that this project is Skills for Crisis, and it's about, you know, these really challenging, difficult, painful times we're living in and trying to like prepare together in our communities to face them. And it made me think about a practice that I've been led through a lot in different ways, sometimes in somatic work, that's about kind of turning and facing what we don't want to face and how much avoidance we all feel of things that we might need to do. Like a lot of people I know feel avoidant about like their digital security stuff, or you know, creating a go bag or making a plan with their neighbors. Like they're just, these things are hard. Like the things we have to do feel really hard because it means like admitting that these really painful conditions are happening and preparing for like the next really difficult thing to happen that we all, of course, wish wouldn't happen. So it made me think about a practice I've used sometimes in my workshops. We might have even done this in the one we did in July in together, but where try to bring into your mind, like, what does it feel like when you feel like you want to avoid something? Like, I don't want to check my email. I don't feel like calling my grandmother. Like, I don't want to do the dishes. Like, whatever the feeling is when you just, like, you know, for some people it might be like you feel like your back is moving away. Like, you're like, get me out of here. Turn my face the other direction. Some people have said they feel tired or, like, sleepy or groggy when they feel avoidant or, like, cranky. You know, whatever that feels like in your body and mind, just bring to mind avoidance. Like, I don't want to face this. Just like, what's that like? And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just a feeling. And it's like totally normal to feel that in a society where we're forced to do a lot of stuff we don't want to do. Like, that's a really reasonable response. Like, we have to go to school and go to jobs and like do things that like are exploitative and coercive. Like, it's good that we know how to feel avoidant. Great. Sometimes you feel avoidant when you don't want to. You're like, actually, I think I do want to, like, do the work I said I would do for my mutual aid group, or I do actually want to, like, you know, make the cake for my friend's birthday or whatever. So then how do we bring about a feeling of doing things on purpose when we want to? So I want to, like, try out, now that we've felt what avoidance feels like, what does it feel like to do something on purpose? And for me, I imagine, like, I feel kind of upright. I feel sort of like I'm leaning forward a little bit. I feel kind of like some upward strength in my spine, like my body's being organized in an upright fashion. I almost imagine like a tall tree. And I'm like, I'm at the ready, I'm going forward. And maybe upright isn't the feeling for some people. Maybe on purpose feels like I can feel all my friends at my back, or I can feel like a clarity or a certain kind of energy. I don't know, like whatever it feels like for you is right. But what does on purpose feel like? Just try to bring that into your body. Like, I'm gonna go ahead and face this. And I wondered if maybe trying that on is interesting for listening to the beginning of a podcast about skills for crisis. You know, like maybe I know that you and I are on purpose. We know why we met through this work. We both care about this. I've seen you facilitate. I know your care for the group, care for your community. I've heard about the huge range of skills that you and your partners in Educat have. I actually saw the way that you all like fed everyone in the group when we had our live workshop, and like it was so beautiful. There was a kind of like care for all of us and a dedication to thinking about how to bring the group together and what topics we were going to work on. Like, you are very intentional, on-purpose people. So I already feel sitting at this table with you, like, our shared on-purpose. And I'm hoping that we can share that with anybody who's listening to or watching this podcast. Like, okay, even if you've never done stuff yet regarding trying to meet the crisis in your community and the crises that are coming for us globally, may listening to this podcast contribute to a connection to your own purpose in these very difficult times. And maybe that's a way to invoke our starting place for this conversation.
Thank you for guiding us through this, kind of maybe also like settling and giving awareness also to, yeah, listening and needs presence, for sure.
I think also that this kind of exercise we can all use whenever we have to do something we feel avoidant of. So I also just wanted to offer it, like, it's just like if before a meeting, before you sit down to answer those difficult emails, before working on something that is a little scary for you, like it can be a thing to try to cultivate the on purpose feeling.
Yeah, I'm also good at avoiding things for sure, and I always think that when we talk about crisis, though, it's also a question of like privilege, right? Because like sometimes there's moments where you know there is no avoiding anymore. Yeah. And that maybe is also the very definition of knowing it's a crisis. There's no avoidance.
Yeah, and ideally, I think we live in societies that tell us to deny these crises are happening as much as possible and as long as possible. And I think the point of where both of our work overlaps is we want to wake up to what's going on sooner and do more sooner to support everybody who's already experiencing the brunt of it and also prepare for that expanding and expanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. You've written a book and you talk a lot about mutual aid. So can you explain to those who don't know maybe what that term means? What is it? And also importantly, like, what is it not? And why do movements need this? Yeah. For their work?
Yeah. Mutual aid, when I use that word, I mean, like, if you imagine our social movements, our resistance movements have like a lot of tactics in them. Like sometimes we're sabotaging a pipeline and sometimes we're, you know, breaking people out of prison and sometimes we're having a big march in the streets and sometimes we're, you know, doing digital security workshops. Like, we do a million things. Sometimes we're making giant puppets, you know, like we do. Sometimes we're babysitting children. Mutual aid is the part of our movement work where we're directly meeting people's needs right now. So where we're babysitting, where we're doing healthcare projects, where we're, you know, giving people somewhere to stay tonight, where we're raising money for your dental bill, like all the things that are about like people's actual immediate crisis needs, that's the mutual aid part of the work. And for me, I would say it's only mutual aid if it's based in a shared understanding that the person or people in crisis are not the problem. The problem is like a system created a crisis. So like if you don't have anywhere to live right now, that's not because like there's something wrong with you. It's because there's something wrong with like this racist, capitalist, colonial housing system, you know? Which is a big deal because our society like blames people in crisis for being in crisis. So this is a very different, it's a very radical idea to instead blame systems and not people. I also would say it's only mutual aid if it includes an invitation to collective action. So we're giving out tents in the park to people who are unhoused. You can have a tent, whether or not you join us, but we invite you. Would you like to join us? Would you like to join the group that's giving out the tents? Would you like to come to the protests we're having next week at the landlord's house? Would you like to be part of this work? You don't have to, but because we believe it's the system that's the problem, we know that collective action is the only thing that would solve it. And so we're trying to pull everybody into it, right? So that is the other thing that makes it mutual aid, is that it's a point of contact for building a strategy to change this. It's not just that we give out tents, it's that we're trying to like end this problem where people are forced to live outside, right? And it's important because it's a distinction from charity. Like in our societies, the place where like people in crisis sometimes are given something is some kind of charity, like NGO or government charity. And charity is based on the idea that, like, first of all, it usually like celebrates rich people or the government. Like, aren't they so wonderful for giving this out? You know, it's like makes the very people who are creating the problem look like they're the solution. We don't believe in that. Charity also blames the people in crisis very directly. It's like, oh, you're unhoused. Maybe you need to take this medication. Maybe you need to go see our doctors. Maybe you should. You know, are you good enough to get on the housing list? It divides people into the deserving and undeserving. Like, you have a criminal history or you have a drug history. So no, you can't be on the waiting list for the housing. You know, like there's kind of a way that charity polices poor people, usually in like a very explicitly racist and xenophobic way. And you know, mutual aid says like everybody deserves everything right now. And charity is like, maybe if you get on this wait list and you take these pills and you don't take these other pills and, you know, you give us all your information about your children. And, you know, like it's very policing as if you are the problem for having, for living the crisis. So that's like the really important distinction. And mutual aid is really committed to the dignity and well-being of all people and believes that people in crisis know like what they need, whereas charity is like, we'll tell you what you need. You know, like in the US, the like charity food program is like, you can buy these foods, but not these foods. Like, we'll tell you what to eat. You know, that level of paternalism and control and stigma is central to charity. And mutual aid is really the reverse of that. It's not top down, it's bottom up. It's like, yeah, we're all gonna support each other because this crisis is, harmful to all people, and the people who are living on the very edge of it right now, we all need to hold them and you know, end this what's causing this crisis. I've been using an image lately that has been really helpful to me that I learned from my friend Peter Gelderlos. He described, if you can imagine, we're sitting next to a giant factory and it's polluting. It's putting out all this pollution and poison. And if we sit next to it and we're sitting there cleaning off rocks and turtles and birds, we're trying to get this poison off of them. If we never also attack the factory and close it down, then we're just going to burn out, right? They're making more poison than we can possibly clean off. So mutual aid is always part of an ecosystem that includes direct action. It's not just cleaning off the turtles. It's also shutting down the factory. Mutual aid might be the part of that work where we're cleaning turtles, but we are connected to, and most of us are also involved in, the work that's about attacking the factory. Those things go together. If it's just cleaning turtles, it might be charity.
I think the cleaning turtles picture, maybe it's like connects very much to when you talk about like giving out, like that mutual aid is the notion and the conviction and the political conviction that everybody deserves everything, and we're not sanctioning who needs this or that, or also we're like cleaning off the poison from the turtle and we think that the reason for it is the factory, let's say. That's a bit like one of the issues with mutual aid that people face who do that kind of work, right? Because like you can spend a lot of time cleaning the turtles and there's only so much sleeping bags and tents and housing that you can give to people. Like most of us, like, you know, we also don't have so much to give, but then like, you know, even the what we have, we might share. And so the question is for me, what are common obstacles that people face while doing that work? How can groups navigate, especially the threat of burnout, conflict, and so on?
Yeah, what you're speaking to is so true. One of the biggest problem in our movements is that there's not enough people in them. Like the amount of people we need to be actively doing stuff to care for others and fight back against the poisonous factories is more. So we need so many more people in our movements, like so many more. You know, we need to have multiple child care projects on every block, and multiple elder care projects on every block, and harm reduction projects, and disaster prep projects. I mean, you can imagine, and we need kind of like almost everybody to be involved in caring for each other, because that is the level of crisis we're in, and certainly more than we have now. And so I think that one thing that's really challenging is that a lot of us find the work hard, and we blame ourselves and each other for how hard it is. When really it's like the conditions. Like, of course it's hard. Of course we couldn't do it perfectly. Of course we couldn't meet everyone's needs. You know, like it's an impossible situation, and that's not a reason to stop. And the thing that's really important is that mutual aid is actually one of the main ways people join movements. Like historically, all social movements do all their fighting back and care for all the people who are getting, you know, hurt, right? That is like what movements do. They do those two things. And most people some people enter movements during the insurrectionary moment where there's a huge uprising in the streets, but a lot of people enter movements because they needed something and they came and you were like, hey, yeah, here, have it. And also you want to join us? I was like, fuck yeah, this sucks, you know? Or I, you know, heard about what's happening. It's so unfair what's happening to these people, or it happened to me before. I want to help. You know, these are the two common entry points. And so we need a lot of mutual aid groups that are ready to let in a lot of new people and welcome them and really get them involved and do political development work and be like, yeah, help people grow their solidarities and learn skills and feel that initiative. And one thing that is a mistake a lot of groups make, which is very understandable, is like we and our 10 friends start a mutual aid group and we never figure out how to really let new people in. We kind of boss people around, and then you move away and I have a kid and somebody else gets sick, and now there's three people in the group, and then we are too small and we burn out and we hate each other. You know, so creating groups that really can welcome new people, and not just welcome them as always being kind of junior, but like bring them in to like real leadership in the group, and so that everybody here knows how to run it. And if you go to jail or you move away, we're not like, uh-oh, that was the only person who understood our spreadsheet or who knew where the keys were to the whatever, had the relationship with the bakery or whatever, you know. So that's a really key piece of this, is like how to make mutual aid projects people growing machines, you know, that like help people become more and more skilled and more understanding of solidarity and more radical. Like, that's vital. Yeah, I think that conflict is a really big obstacle to mutual aid work and all organizing work. There's a few things. You know, we live in a conflict avoidance societies that where most of us, I mean, honestly, don't even really know how to say like no to each other about kind of anything. Partly because we live in coercive societies that force us to work and go to school and all of, you know, be in these hierarchies, and so we're all kind of like, you know, we manipulate to get by, to survive. We like feel guilty if we have to say no to anyone about anything. It's very intense. That's really hard. And then also, because I think of the way that racial capitalism works, we're all very oriented towards like outcomes. We're like, how many meals did we get out? How many banner drops did we do? How many people came to our march? You know, like there's a kind of like when we get together to do something important, it's very external facing. And we often kind of ignore what's going on in the group. We don't kind of set things up to be very intentional. And if you don't add intentions, you're going to do like societal norms. So it's kind of going to be like, I'm bossing you around and you're following what I say. Or some people are getting left out, or some people are being cliquish, or, you know, all these just things that are just like the way our society works just come into our radical space. Even though those aren't aligned with our radical ideas, we don't usually have something else in place unless we create it. But we don't create it because we're so busy getting out all those meals and turning out all those people to the next march. And so a lot of my work has been about helping groups that are doing something really important also try to think about what's happening inside the group and realize that that matters a lot, even though it's easy to ignore, and that it's really like a feminist, anti-racist, disability justice thing to be like, it actually matters how we treat each other in here. And also, if we don't pay attention to it, our work is going to end. Like, that's what mostly happens in organizing groups of all kinds, is that we start out, we both care so much about this thing and we're doing it, but, and maybe we get on for the first 6 months or the first 12 months or something, and then our group erupts in all of this conflict. And it was like, I never told you how I felt about anything. I was, you know, breeding resentments about how you were always late or how you didn't listen to me or whatever. You know, there were power dynamics that we weren't speaking to, and now we're all really mad about them. So there's some really basic things that groups can do that we did some of these in our workshop, and all this kind of, these kinds of models are all like free on my website. There's videos about how to do the workshops and slides and stuff, so I hope people will use them. And I have a new podcast where we also go over skills like this. So hopefully this stuff is easy to find. But, you know, things like spending 20 minutes in your group meeting talking about how to give and receive feedback directly, so that I can be like, Fine, you know, when you're late to the meetings, it has this impact on me. I wonder if you would work on it. And you practice like, okay, what's it like to not be defensive and to be like, thanks, Dean, I hear what you're saying. I know you really want to work with me, and that's why you're saying this, you know. And just like, what does it mean for us to try to like learn how to be a little more direct and not take things really personally, and really notice that people's feedback is actually an investment in the relationship and continues and connects. Doing things like making it clear how decisions are made. And a lot of groups, they have no plan around how decisions are made. And so if you started the group, or if you're kind of the loudest person or the most charismatic person, you end up telling us what to do, or you told people in the community we would do this, and the rest of us were like, we don't have enough energy, or we don't have enough food, or why'd you go promising that, you know, and there's no clarity. Or you posted it on Instagram from our group, and we are all like, what the fuck, you know, like, so figuring out how decisions are made, how people get heard, doing methods of facilitation where we make sure we hear from quiet people, where we make sure nobody's bossing us all around, like, just like some very basic things, putting them in place, talking about the culture of our group. How does it feel here? Is it fun? Are we welcoming to new people? Are we mean to each other? Are we impatient? You know, like, what can we do to make it be a place that we could all stick around? Very basic things, but they can make a huge difference. If you just crack the door on having those kinds of conversations, then people can say stuff when it comes up instead of it being bottled up and then they just disappear and they're not part of the group anymore, or there's a big fight. So a lot of the like skills-based stuff that's in the mutual aid book and in the videos on my website and in the podcast is about like how to prevent some of those really big blow-ups and like just keep, make the work so that the group can keep going.
Yeah, that reminds me of so many
experiences.
Groups and moments. And yeah, I think people can relate for sure. Yeah. I remember in one of the workshops, you said a sentence which was stuck is like, when I feel most victimized, I do the most harm. And yeah, I wanted to know if you can say a bit more about that, which is related to what you just said.
Yeah, it is related. Yeah, yeah, that's been an important idea for me. So I think we get to these moments in groups. It could be with roommates. It could be with people who are collaborating on an art project. It could be people in a mutual aid project trying to feed people on their block, you know, whatever group you're in. You get to these moments where it's like heightened feeling. You know, you never do the dishes, or, you know, you don't listen to me. You know, like when we're feeling really heightened, that's often a crisis for the group. And it's, you know, it's often about to be, maybe I'm about to do something really intense, like violate your privacy or speak negatively about you with others or post something online about you or send you a mean text. Those moments, usually when I'm about to do something that's kind of disruptive or disorganizing or harmful to other people, in that moment, I am feeling like the victim. It's kind of surprising, right? Because when we see other people do that stuff, we're like, they're being the aggressor. We feel like, how, I can't believe they did that. It's so messed up. But when we're doing it, it doesn't label itself like, Dean, you're about to do harm. I don't know that inside. I think, I can't believe Fiona did this stuff. I'm finally going to tell them what I think, you know? And so in the workshop, I was talking about that when we feel the most victimized, that's the time to be like, uh-oh, yellow flag. I need to get some support from a friend before I press send on this message, before I take that next kind of reactive step. I need to say, hey, can you talk through with me what I'm really mad about this thing in the group? I'm thinking about doing this. And then in the workshop, I also gave some guidance around how to listen to people when they're really upset. Because when someone's really upset, a lot of us just either like get scared and shut down, or we kind of try to get them to shut up by giving them advice or like telling them it's not a big deal. When you minimize what's happening for someone, they often get more upset. Or we join them and we're like, yeah, let's get them. And we get into a revenge thing with them. And that all of that is very bad for our communities. The thing people usually need is someone to just really be there with them. Like, that sounds so hard. Wow, that sounds like you're really hurting. You don't have to collaborate with the idea that someone else is bad, nor do you have to say it's not happening. And just be with the person and let them go through this wave of experience and see, you know, if they start to talk about doing something that's really damaging, you can be like, I don't think that's our values. Let's wait on that or whatever. You can help them not do something they're going to regret later. But mostly people just need people to stay with them. And I think what happens in a lot of our groups is you were really upset and no one listened to you. And then now you're even more upset and you're out for blood in the community. Or I listened to you and I joined you and I was like, yeah, those people are horrible. And I helped you create a huge, you know, Instagram thing about how bad everybody else is. Or, you know, I didn't listen to you at all. And now you're really isolated and you're not in our group anymore. You know, so just like, can we be with people when they're upset? And when we're upset, can we get support and know, oh, I'm upset right now. Maybe don't take action. I think those skills could help us not have some of the worst moments of conflict that break up our groups and disorganize our movements. I'm hopeful about that.
Yeah, thank you so much. It also reminds me and makes a good connection, I feel like, to the other workshop that we did in Berlin in July as well, which was like on recentering mental health with Collective Care Berlin. You were there as well for some of the methods, and I remember we did some nervous system regulation, which is like this, what you just mentioned, like, you know, like you feel the victim, you feel like something's not right, and probably like we all feel that way, right? And in a society where it's also probably true, and at the same time, like, what do we do with it then? And like, conflict itself also makes us be aroused a lot and be like, if we're like, we didn't learn that it's safe to go into conflict, then we like learn that we should actually not do it or not say it or yeah. And then it's easier to go around and like tell a friend, tell a comrade that this is not okay, instead of like, yeah, calming down, thinking how can we talk about it together, and then like one person needs to be the one who's like actively listening and be like, oh, I hear that you're hurting, and now what? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that we can actually continue doing the work that we started to do, actually, why we wanted to meet in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. Which is usually not unlearning our conflict behavior.
Right. And also it's always multiple things happening. Like, I think a lot of times when we have a fight in a political resistance movement, if I feel unhappy with something you've done and I'm freaking out, I will just have a bunch of political reasons. I'll be like naming all the things that are wrong politically, but I won't also be aware of the emotional and interpersonal and group dynamics. So both things are happening. Like both, I felt marginalized because I was trans and something, and I also felt not listened to, and that reminds me of, you know, how I've often felt in this society or in my family. Like, it's happening on a social, emotional level and on a political level, but we get really obsessed with the political language, and it becomes about like showing that you're wrong and I'm right on like some kind of objective scale of our politics. I think because we live in an anti-conflict society where you're not allowed to have conflict, when we have it, it's like I must win and be right, or else I'm bad. Somebody has to be bad and somebody has to be thrown away. It's like very cursory. And so being able to be more like, oh, like, well, we worked closely together, so not surprisingly, we stirred each other up. We're in that stirred up phase right now. Right now, when I think of you, I think negative things and I feel fears or judgments or criticism. This is not how I will always feel. It's not how I've always felt. Can I be with this, figure out what's actually really important for me to ask you? Do I have any requests, you know, that are like, that are not reactive things about you disappearing from the face of the earth, not being part of our movements anymore? You know, these are the kinds of things people fantasize about when they're upset. You know, can I be like, yeah, okay, right now you're not my favorite person in the world, but I don't need to destroy you. Like, can we find, you know, we talk about this in the abolition movement as like a right-sized response. Maybe you did something that I really wish you hadn't done. What's the right-sized response for our communities? You know, that may not be like satisfying my deepest revenge fantasy, but like, that's actually not our values, you know? And this takes a lot. Like, I think it's very hard to hold this alone. This is why we need to have friends and why we need people in our movement groups to be friendly towards each other. Like, even if we are in the same group and we wouldn't have chosen each other as friends, our personalities clash or we're not the similar, can I still be a friend to you when you're upset? Or can you be a friend to me and be like, I'm going to listen, I'm going to help you sort out what's a right-sized response to this? Like, can we be there for each other? A lot of times when people are in conflict, either people abandon them or they like go towards them and stir it more. You know, can I be like, oh no, I'm going to care for the whole group right now by being like supportive of you, but not stirring you to a higher level of upset.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. Let's embrace that and be friends and comrades to each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we slowly wrap it up.
Great.
What I find very powerful about your work is, for me, is that it connects that solidarity actually is about providing food, shelter, housing. It is about basic needs. It is about us providing each other and helping each other out in existential needs. And it is also about care and conflict skills and learning how to defend each other when the institutions are off doing their things and making our life worse. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I appreciate this connection of not focusing on one or the other. Mm-hmm. So
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we can't do any of our work if we don't care for how we do it. You know what I mean? There's no providing all the things people need without being people in a group. And so we kind of, whether we like it or not, have to do both. And also, we're trying to create the new world in which we are the new people who could be in it, who know how to care for each other and know how to not act like a bunch of bosses or extractors or, you know, have a pecking order and hierarchy. Like, we're trying to become the people who could live in a world where everybody has everything and nobody profits off other people's basic needs. And the way to become that is to practice it right now in whatever we're doing. It's not like, we'll give out this food now and then someday we'll practice the relational skills. There's no, you have to do it now, unfortunately. There's no like putting it off, you know?
Yeah, let's practice. Thank you for giving us more insights and impulses to think about it and self-reflect, and also maybe some motivation back to get back into activism, who knows, and try better next time.
Yeah, thank you for all the organizing that you guys are doing and trying to spread ideas that support people. I think it's very beautiful.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah, you can find also some presentations and insights on the workshop that we did on our website, www.skillsforcrisis.org. Thank you, Dean, so much for having us. Or you having us, me having you.
Good enough.
Us having each other. Thank you so much. Good luck with your work in Berlin.